The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today when I was shaving, I was just thinking, this is the weirdest time of the 26 years that I've done this in these markets as far as just the wrong pricing for everything. You know, you've got fewer and fewer participants in the stock market, yet it's hitting all-time highs. You have more and more demand for gold. I mean, we've got supply issues for gold, yet the price is going down. Now, have the paper markets and the manipulations taken over so much that nothing really actually is priced correctly anymore?
Well, the interventionism that we've seen from the world's various central banks have basically become what we would call a liquidity backstop. You know, we've talked about the Greenspan put.
Right.
We've talked about the Bernanke put and the fact that really markets can't go down as long as central banks are actively intervening in the market. Well, what they are doing is warping certain realities, and they are adding a tremendous amount of volatility to the market, both present and future. We see in the last week emerging market volatility going off the charts. I mean, we had 3%, various equity markets in the emerging markets down from 3 to 10%. We had also in the emerging markets, in the area of bonds, a literal freeze-up. I mean, almost worse than 2008 just this last week. Bond market volatility, both in the emerging markets as well as in Japan and in Europe and the United States. And, of course, we began to see some strange things. A massive spike in Portuguese yields on the basis of a change in Japanese policy. Yes, that's correct. There is a connection because
so for
it's been Japanese money that's been going and buying European debt.
So for all the income-hungry people out there right now who want a little bit of safety, they could go buy Portuguese bonds and maybe get an income for, what, a week?
Or if they don't mind risk, they can just buy sushi.
Well, so, okay, but mortgage rates as well, though, David. I mean, you talk about a liquidity backstop. When the government's buying every mortgage, how in the world do you actually know what the interest rates are supposed to be?
Well, and they are. Those are backing up. They're about 4% now. They've been as high as 4.10%, up off of 3.6% at the lows. And at the same time, with all the interventionism we've seen and sort of the warping and twisting of realities that we've seen, you don't have real economic activity.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things we looked at when we assessed Chinese growth and sort of a change in growth trends was that electricity usage last year was dropping precipitously, even while the Chinese government was claiming that there was even better growth in the economy. And yet again, electricity usage is dropping.
So there was growth, but they were doing it more efficiently, or there wasn't growth like they were saying.
Bloomberg has a great chart on waste carloads. And again, this is just one of those subtle indicators that we are not buying, spending, using, and throwing away as much as we used to. We're at levels we haven't seen since the recession of 2000-2001, worse only by 1 year, 2008-2009, that time frame. So waste carloads are very low. U.S. economy is not fully in recovery. The S&P, it continues to be an anomaly,
yeah,
to say the least, because again, it's not supported by economic or fundamental realities. We've talked about the divergence between copper and the S&P. We've talked about the divergence between durable goods and the S&P. We've talked about the divergence in terms of S&P moving higher and consumer confidence moving lower. All of these three things not reflecting really something that investors can wrap their minds around and say, this is reality. This is what I'm dealing with.
Well, and you know, most people who have equities watch the Dow Jones Industrial Average because that's what everybody has in their mind. But the S&P 500, there are certain moving averages that people watch, the traders watch, and they know that if it's breached, it could be an issue. And I think the 50-day moving average right now is still probably one of the key indicators right now of the direction of the S&P 500, is it not?
Yeah, for the last 18 months, it's come down, it's tested that level, it's bounced right off of it, and it's moved higher. It may be that we are seeing the end of that trend, in part because each of the bounces off of the 50-day moving average have been fairly robust. 6, 8, 10% recoveries off of a correction to the 50-day. This particular bounce is lackluster, you could say. So the question is, will we retest? Will that number hold the level of the 50-day moving average? And if it doesn't, you should probably prepare for the worst.
Well, David, like I was talking, I was standing looking in the mirror this morning and shaving and realizing that everything's distorted. Now, I wasn't talking about myself, of course, But, you know, okay, but like, let's talk about price distortions, like being at one of those carnivals that, you know, the mirrors are all different shapes, and you can't really tell whether you're tall, thin, fat, whatever. It's not giving real data.
Exactly. You could be skinny as a rail or look like a beach ball getting ready to be rolled down the street.
Right.
It is. It's distorted, and you have to step back, and once you do, the amusement's over. This is the challenge, though. Today is anything but amusing. When we witness this sort of incestuous relationship between the Fed and the Treasury, which is distorting and distending reality,
right.
The trouble is they're not only temporarily reshaping a view or a perspective, they're attempting to reshape how we all perpetually view the world.
Well, and you know, it's a shame. The people who actually can see what's not distorted in the mirror, the people who are printing the money and actually redistributing it, they're taking the savings of the person who doesn't have the inside information. I mean, there's huge challenges for investors right now because they're having to look into this mirror and try to make good decisions, and it's purposely being distorted.
Now, beyond the usual smoke and mirror games from Wall Street, you have the recovery narrative, and that's, of course, from the powers that be.
Right.
This is a government that's desperate to prove that socialism is not a failure. In fact, it is a great success.
And well, have we ever seen a centralized planned government, socialism, let's say, work in the end? It's not productive.
The Soviet Union is testament to that. You've got central planning, you've got price fixing at the Fed, no different. What it creates is downstream distortions. Now, you look at what is high-powered reserves today created by the Fed. This is the fuel for inflation that's coming. Okay, the average middle-class family, are they benefiting from the liquidity infusions the Fed has had in play over the last 18 to 24 months?
Not at all. I mean, look at the sales, Dave, at some of these retail outlets that, quote, a normal person shops at. Okay, they're dropping right now.
Same-store sales down for Walmart, down for Target. This is all in the first quarter. Down for Kohl's, down for Sears, down for Costco, down
right.
for Costco. I mean, you want to save a few bucks, buy big, buy in bulk.
So it's a recovery that nobody's actually going and buying anything.
Well, it's pinched either from a lack of sufficient income or from an increase in the cost of goods. That's what's happening, is budgets are being pinched on one of those two bases.
Yeah, but David, the opposite is the truth.
Well,
when you pointed this out in the past, the high-end restaurants, the high-end retailers like Tiffany's, they're not having a problem at all right now.
No. Tiffany's is near its all-time high in terms of stock price. Saks is at a recovery high. Saks Fifth Avenue, it's about seven times better than it was in 2009 off of those lows. And the numbers are they're better in large measure because the stimulus in the system has already inflated the value of assets owned by the wealthiest Americans. So this is those with a strong stock portfolio and those with a big house. Now, listen, this is the same thing that's been communicated to the Bank of Japan. If you do as we do, you
sure.
will find the same success that we've had. And we may have mentioned this a few weeks ago. The problem with that is there's less than 7% of the Japanese public that actually owns equities. So even though the Nikkei has been rallying, it's corrected here in the last few days, but
right.
even though it's rallied better than 25% in the last 6 months, it's been to the benefit of foreign speculators and hedge funds as much as it has, and even more than it has, individuals in the Japanese economy who, on the basis of a wealth effect, may then turn around and increase consumption spending and generate further growth in the Japanese economy.
Well, and Dave, when there's been a devaluation of currency, whether it's here in America or whether it's in Japan or wherever they want to try to imitate this miracle that our Federal Reserve has supposedly brought about, has there ever been an exception through history when a lot of money's been printed where you didn't have devaluation of the currency, or another word for it, inflation?
Axiomatic would be the word to use.
Yeah.
It follows that when you create these high-powered monetary reserves, inflation is in the pipeline. It's around the corner. There is a lag, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But it is the Fed that's granted sort of extra money for shopping. Again, whether it's Saks Fifth Avenue, whether it's Tiffany's, whether it's Barney's in Manhattan. Main Street, meanwhile, is edging closer to stagflation. I mean, again, that's the frustrating circumstances of stagnant wage growth, rising costs. This is what's complements of the Fed if you're Main Street as opposed to somehow connected to Wall Street or, frankly, a part of the 1 or 2%.
You know, this behavior reminds me, Dave, of there was a movie, I'm sure some of the listeners saw it, of a man who decided to try an experiment, and that is to just eat at McDonald's every meal for a month. And if they asked to, it's called supersize, because if they asked if they wanted to supersize it, he would supersize anytime they do it. But in the beginning, he didn't really notice any real change. In other words, he looked like he was eating well and things were going fine. But he started developing health issues. He started gaining weight. Diabetes started to look like it was going to become a problem. And, you know, we see this in life, Dave. We see abuse. You know, no offense to our listeners who smoke, but let's face it, why are you still smoking? Okay. We see how people die after they've smoked. Okay. We see how people die when they eat too much fat and saturated fat. Yet they continue to do that. And I think about the way the Fed behaves.
There's
right
lagging
now.
Consequences.
And the Japanese are now going, you know, I sort of like what I see. I think I'll go ahead and order that Big Mac, and why don't you supersize it for me?
But, okay, so for years we've been gold bulls,
right.
And we still are. Well, actually, we're rather battered gold bulls, to be precise.
We're getting beat up right now, yeah.
But what we'd like to share maybe is a few insights that clarify, maybe they affirm, what the upward trajectories of the precious metals are. With 40-plus years of daily trading the metals, I think we have a few things to either inspire, or at least in this case, if you're feeling like a battered gold bull, at least console.
Well, and it reminds me of our interview with your dad a couple of weeks ago. Dave, he was able to bring insight from the 1970s into the dialogue, and it's so valuable to go back and actually talk to somebody who lived, breathed, and went through the emotional ups and downs.
Particularly the 75 to 76 period, the gold consolidations, we've suggested that there are similarities to what we see today, 2012, 2013. We've even asked whether the summer of 76 and the summer of 2013 don't in some way mirror each other. Mm. Actually, some fairly significant ways in which they're similar. I mean, then and now, we have Ben Bernanke working sort of his monetary wizardry.
Reminds me of Arthur Burns in the 70s, Dave.
Exactly. That was his predecessor in the office of Federal Reserve Chief. And he had the immediate impact in terms of Arthur Burns' monetary policy of positive response in the equity market, inflation neutral, although that's arguable depending on how you count inflation.
Right.
And coincidentally, again, in the 70s, there was this point in time where central banks around the world would not allow the dollar to depreciate further. You had five central banks coming in and making sure that the devaluation that we saw in the early 70s was arrested in the mid-70s. So Arthur Burns looks and says, look at this. I mean, come on.
They're going to come in and intervene. They're going to buy the dollar every time I... Yeah.
When are they going to make me Sir Arthur Burns? And because this was the idea.
The genius of printing money.
Exactly.
Yes.
I made the equity market go up. There is no inflation. The dollar is stable. Someone hand me the laurel wreath.
But what do we remember Arthur Burns for? Okay.
He lit the fuse.
Yeah, yeah.
He lit the fuse. And so has our Arthur, that is Ben Bernanke. Ben will be remembered as the man that set the fuse alight. The U.S. debt market, specifically. They've been building steam. They've been progressively moving higher in price for the last 30 years. And they needed somebody to jack them up even higher and now push the market from its roost. You've got a number of people in the bond market, not only Bill Gross, but others now joining the chorus, including Dallas Fed President Richard Fisher, saying, listen, the bond bowl is over. We've got a different financial landscape ahead of us in terms of the cost of capital. That's what we can expect in the future.
Well, and let's look at the flip side of that. When someone says the bond bowl is over, that means that the drop in interest rates is over, because when bonds go up, it's interest rates going down. So
the person who doesn't necessarily
invest in bonds or understand that, your ability to borrow at lower rates is just about to go away.
Going away.
Yeah.
The dollar has been in decline for decades, so we can't put responsibility for the dollar's demise on Ben's shoulders, and that would be to let sort of Mr. Burns, Mr. Greenspan, let these guys off the hook, because they've certainly contributed to what we've made in terms of a dollar mess.
But could we credit Ben with some inflation when it finally does occur? I mean, he's going to be known for that, isn't he?
We can credit him with any acceleration in the rate of inflation. And
right.
This is, again, okay. The nature of... Irony is sweet. The articles that today laud Ben Bernanke, whether it's Bloomberg or others in the financial press, and they point out how, again, this is sort of wizardry. His brand of wizardry, it's just different this time.
Right.
You've got money printing, you've got monetization, you've got the general expansion of credit along with the ballooning of the Fed's balance sheet. And lo and behold, it has not created what it always created in the past. In fact, this is a miracle of management to be remembered for all time. I mean, this is, again, I say irony is sweet because today we can inflate a currency, but we do not reap any inflationary outcomes in the prices of goods and services. Unfortunately, this is his legacy. This will be his legacy. One of the few things that he is remembered for, the financial press is not connecting the dots. The financial press is in the business of selling advertising, not understanding the realities, the relationships between high-powered monetary reserves and an inflationary outcome, not just for the man in the street, but every man, Main Street, Wall Street, everybody dealing with inflationary consequences to bad monetary policy.
Well, and Dave, the financial press, this is showbiz. I mean, let's face it, you're on three times, sometimes four times a week on national TV. They don't want to hear your deep insights. They just want to hear little sound bites to keep people watching.
Well, and the frustrating thing for investors is to suffer through the lag time between the two. Mm. The actions which do create inflation and the reality, at least the social recognition of that reality.
Well, and Dave, can I make a suggestion at this point? You know, last week's guest has a site called PricedInGold.com, but he's got a great chart over on the right you can click that basically shows the half-life of the dollar, and it follows a very, very regular chart, but you also see that it vacillates up and down above the curve. So you can see that sometimes you've got inflation, sometimes you don't, but overall, the half-life of the dollar shows this inflationary trend.
Well, and when we talk about Arthur Burns and the disconnect between his monetary policies and the inflation of the late 70s and the monetary policy of Ben Bernanke today and the disconnect between that and the inflation which is immediately around the corner, again, the lag relates to the non-monetary element in the equation. And I think this is what a lot of people don't appreciate. The non-monetary element in the equation, this is crowd psychology, this is the social acknowledgement of a real state of affairs, and this goes well beyond John Williams and his reporting at shadowstats.com.
Right.
We know it exists. We already have inflation. The critical juncture just ahead is when people's investment decisions are altered to reflect what they already know, what they're dealing with their family budgets. That is to say, the rising cost of everything.
Well, and you know, I'll tell you what, you're talking about inflation, and one of the best ways to measure inflation is the way Volcker measured inflation back in the early 80s. But Volcker, he's seeing through this right now. Volcker's the guy who had to come clean up after Arthur Burns, and it was very, very painful. 80, 81, 82. Those interest rate hikes, the, you know, the recession that we went through, those were the first Reagan years, and Volcker had something to say just recently about this.
Kevin, do you remember our conversation with Otmar Issing? He was very hesitant to offer any critique or criticism of the European Central Bank because he figured he had had his day in the sun, 8 years as a leader at the European Central Bank,
right,
and he was not in a position to, in any way, compromise, or he didn't want anything he said to compromise current ECB policy or be taken as criticism or in some way undermine those who were in power. It's very interesting because I don't know that we have the same kind of decorum today. In the last 30 days here in the States, we've had Greenspan and we've had Volcker step forward and say, listen, about this radical monetary policy that's in place today, you have to be careful with the consequences. You don't know when sometimes you're dealing with fire. You don't want to get burned. Be very careful here. They're still couching what they say diplomatically.
Right.
But the fact that they're out in the public square, this is Volcker in a recent speech at the Economics Club of New York. And I think this is probably his most direct public opposition, if you want to call it that, to current Fed monetary policy. He's not naming names, but here's what he said. He says, credibility is an enormous asset. Of course, he's speaking of the Fed. Once earned, it must not be frittered away by yielding to the notion that a little inflation right now is a good thing. A good thing to release animal spirits and to pep up investment. The implicit assumption behind that siren call must be that the inflation rate can be manipulated to reach economic objectives. Up today, maybe a little more tomorrow, and then pulled back on command. Good luck with that. All experience demonstrates that inflation, when fairly and deliberately started, is hard to control and reverse.
Well, and I think it's interesting, as you read through the rest of that speech, he's very careful to say now, Ben Bernanke is very capable and he's got many, many tools. So, of course, he couched it politically, but the things that he's saying right here, when he's saying, good luck with that, that's a little like the guy who's just about to base jump. And you say, you know, I want to go on record ahead of time to let you know that this is a bad idea.
The odds are you'll survive, but you're taking risks that are frankly unnecessary.
Right.
Because keep in mind, you know, these kinds of speeches, it's not like the topic's pre-assigned. You choose your own topic. What's on your mind? What do you want to share? Well, listen, if we're getting ready to come off the rails, it's important that you be on record saying, listen, I said this was a bad idea. And in fact, he has said it's a bad idea. And so, you know, we look at the recent Fed record of easy money policies, and we look at the crashes that followed, and we have easy money policies of the late 90s, which led to the tech bubble. We had the easy money policies in response to the tech bust, which led to the housing finance bubble.
Well, and can I just say, Greenspan also, just like Volcker, he's a public figure, and he exited stage left just before the financial crisis. If you recall, Greenspan, they called him the maestro. They wrote a big book about him. He had created this bubble, and then he exited just in time to say, hey, I think this might be a bad idea.
I think he called himself the maestro.
he might have, yeah.
Yes, he stood in front of a mirror, too, and there was no distortion of reality.
Of
no inflation
not.
Of self.
Mirror,
no
mirror
egotism.
On the wall.
Well, you know, you follow the 08 and 09 bust, and the Fed, yeah, they've staked their claim on a recovery story, but the thing is, they've done this a dozen different times, whether it's talking about green shoots or, you know, this quarter we're expecting this amount of growth. They've over-optimistically assumed that we were in recovery a number of times in the last 4 to 5 years. Now, here's what's really telling. The assumption has always been, by economists, that we would have this pent-up demand coming back into the economy. So everyone tightens their belt in the context of the recession, and then you have this resurgence of buying pent-up demand.
Right.
Guess what? Pent-up demand on average is 6 to 7% in terms of major purchases, and we're less than half of that today in terms of pent-up demand coming back in and seeing consumers step in and buy. The consumer's absent. The consumer is not doing what he's supposed to do, and these are the worst numbers that we've seen in a post-recessionary period since the end of World War II. So, I mean, and again, there is this optimistic assumption that we have arrived, recovery is here, we've had QE 1, 2, 3, 4, we've had twist, now we're discussing taper instead of discussing what was 6 months ago, 12 months ago, an exit strategy
right.
from the $85 billion in bond purchases. These are extraordinary monetary measures. And frankly, even if they just taper, let's go back to that word. Even if you reduced it by 15 to 20%, you still have extraordinary monetary measures, something that we haven't seen in any period in financial history.
Well, so, and David, you're talking about 7% being normal pent-up demand. I mean, 7% is what we're adding to the GDP right now with quantitative easing. So if they took it all away, it's still, I mean, you see what I'm saying? The pent-up demand does not replace quantitative easing. And you've said it's at half of that right now.
Well, we find ourselves today with a growing audience. And this is, again, just let's step back and say, you know, what is reality?
Or is this the new normal?
Well, isn't that the question? And you have a growing audience, mainly in Asia, of investors who, you know, look, the levitation of assets, is this the new normal? Can you do this forever?
Mm-hmm.
Is this what we have missed in sort of the alchemy of old? You don't need to own gold. We can create it out of dirt. I mean, that was the magical dream of alchemy for thousands of years, is that it actually was not a scarce item. You could turn dirt into the precious metal.
Well, and here's the irony. You said it was the Chinese who were thinking this. I mean, paper came from China. Paper currency originated in China. So this whole alchemy, like you're talking about it, the replacement for gold is paper. Maybe this is happening.
Yeah, and there are limits to what the Fed can do. And this is what's being questioned by a growing number of investors. Again, primarily in Asia. Importantly, what are the consequences
right.
to what has already been done? So in the short run, we have, well, and again, this is the majority of investors. I guess I'm thinking about those in the West that have determined that the Fed, the Bank of Japan, the ECB, the Bank of England, they've kept everything under control, that they have solved the problems. There is no more upset to the markets of tomorrow because they have it well in hand. Inflation is
well anchored. Well, Ben says it's well anchored. That's right. Ben says inflation's well anchored. Don't worry about it.
And growth is a near certainty. Honestly, I finished reading 3 dozen Bloomberg articles this morning, and I felt myself feeling almost convinced of the same thing, that growth is inevitable. I mean, it was almost like saying the Pledge of Allegiance and singing My Country, 'Tis of Thee, and all of a sudden I just felt welling up inside of me this sense of things are getting better, much better, and all as a result of reading Bloomberg. And heck, the majority may be right. And frankly, if they are, Kevin, who needs gold?
Dave, strangely, sometimes you sound like your dad, and sometimes, in this particular case, you're not sounding like your dad, because one of the things that he over and over and over said was, the majority is almost always wrong.
And I think that's written into my DNA. So there we are with gold. Yes, suffering in price, suffering a shift in sentiment. Again, not a universal shift in sentiment. So the negative sentiment has been amongst Western money managers, asset managers, and they've boldly just stood up and said, listen, if the Fed's playing the music, we've got to get up and dance. And so it is the fund managers and hedge funds here in the United States and in Western Europe that are now fully invested. In fact, they're as invested in equities as they were at the peak in 2007, just prior to the crash.
Hmm.
But on the other hand, you've got the East, and that's a different story altogether. Our liquidations of gold have been their purchases, what they have considered compelling prices, and then this I think in retrospect will be one of the sort of great west to east wealth transfers in all of history. And it's done in the belief that Ben Bernanke, let's just call him Ben B,
right,
and Arthur Burns are not themselves playing from the same book of tunes. And this is the irony. It's the same song. It's the same dance. We've been here. We've done this before. And it's only people with a sense of history that are saying to themselves, yeah, I think gold makes a good bit of sense right about now. And anyone with the lack of appreciation for history who's saying, this is great. Not only is it good, it's getting better. Look at what the banks of the world are doing for us, the central banks, that is. It's time to party.
Dave, something I learned one time when we were traveling in New York, and, we're from the West. It's pretty dry here. But when you travel to other parts of the world like New York, where the weather can change instantly, I was watching when we were getting ready to film one of the DVDs, a lot of the New Yorkers, it was a beautiful day, but they were walking around with umbrellas. They all seemed to have umbrellas, and I'm thinking, do New Yorkers just do that? Do they just walk around with an umbrella?
Fashion statement.
And I will tell you, okay, from that point forward, we had 3 days of downpour. I remember having to buy several because the wind was so high that it just tore them up. But I thought about that at the time. I thought, you know what? Just because the weather's sunny, if you're a local and you know to carry an umbrella, if you're from outside, you better get one. Gold's like that.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
People are carrying umbrellas, but they're in Asia right now. The Americans have left them at home.
For the contrarians, yeah, we would see being very near a low in price. You've got the time frame of over 20 months of a correction. You've got general sentiment, which is ugly. You've got the price, which is corrected a sufficient amount to be consistent with all the past corrections within the context of this bull market. Maybe we retest the lows in the low 1300s. That can't be ruled out. But we shift toward gold's strong seasonal trend in July, heading towards August, September, October.
Are typically good months for gold.
And here's maybe an insight, which, well, again, if you're a battered gold bug or maybe just a gold owner, resentfully so, maybe you'll revel in this. When you look at who owns gold, what and what bets are being made on the price of gold, you actually have a near certainty as to its next major step. You know, so this is good news, I would consider. And I think would indicate that we are moving not only higher in price, but considerably higher. And I would look for the beginning of this. If it's not July, then it's certainly August, at least on this appraisal. Now look at this. Commercial interests, these are your miners. These are your manufacturers. These are guys with, let's face it, they're on the ball in terms of the direction of the market they operate in.
These are the guys who have to hedge their bets to be able to stay profitable while they're out mining gold.
Commercials have lightened their short positions. They're actually increasing purchases of gold in the futures market, and prices are at or near the cost of production. For any of these guys, this is considered a value. Let's suss this out a little bit. What I'm talking about is, let's say gold at $1,400 today has a cost of production of $1,400.
Right.
It's a little bit lower than that, but let's just call it that. You have nothing to hedge. You have no profit margin at all. You're worried about surviving, okay? There's no reason to short gold to lock in your margin because you have no margin.
So if gold were to drop to 700, you couldn't produce.
No, you're out of business.
Yeah.
But let's say your cost of production is 300.
Right.
Now you're talking about the difference between the cost of production, 300, and the current price of gold, 1400. There's an $1,100 margin which needs to be protected.
Right.
For you to short gold as a commercial interest, all you're doing is locking in your profit of $1,100 per ounce. The reason you're not seeing a lot of commercial shorts today is because you're so close to the cost of production. They don't have enough margin to protect for it to be worthwhile shorting the market. In other words, where's the downside? All we have is upside, or we're going broke. I mean, that's basically the attitude. And on the other side of the equation, you've got the speculative shorts, speculative shorts. These are individual investors that have increased their short positions to levels greater than what we saw in 1999 to 2001.
Which, let's, as a reminder, 1999 to 2001 was the bottom of the gold market.
The lowest prices that we had seen coming off of the peaks at 875 in 1980, all the way down, that downtrend all the way down.
So these guys could not have been more wrong.
And this is, again, we have seen spikes in speculative short interest. If you want to look at the commitment of traders reports that's published by the CFTC on a weekly basis, if you're looking at those reports, what you see now and over the last several weeks is a spike in the speculative short category. Why is this important? Because it has always preceded major moves higher in price. So again, is it July? Is it August? You have to say, well, when are these goons going to throw in the towel? When are they going to say, we're not getting what we wanted in terms of further down prices, and now we have to cover and buy back our position in order to cover those short positions?
You know, something that strikes me interesting, Dave, is Rubini came out, and he's a highly respected economist. He came out last week, and he said that gold is in a bear market. It's going to drop down below 1,000. But what they didn't tell you when they were playing that interview is that each time gold hit a bottom right before it moved to a new high, one, you're right, the speculative shorts had huge positions, but then Rubini had publicly come out in 2008, 2010. He came out and he said, you know, this is it. Gold's over. It's a worthless investment. So when you listen to someone who, quote, is highly respected, you probably ought to go back and, especially these days with the internet, you can Google the quotes and see whether they were right any time before.
Well, again, over the last 60 to 90 days, you've seen this building of the short position, and that has helped drive the price lower. Covering the short position then comes in competition with a natural number of buyers, and this drives the price crazy. This happened in 76, the summer of 76. This happened not only from that point, but all through 77,
right,
when prices were not only recovering their previous peaks, but setting new all-time highs, finally going on to ring the bell at $875 an ounce, 750% higher off of those lows. It also happened more recently, 2005, and again in 2008. So you remember that while volatility on the downside is not fun, for a veteran of the last 10 years, I would suggest that your memory of past painful experiences is not all that clear. And again, that's because you've had a displacement of pain with something that has been greater proportionally. The pleasure or the benefit of the recovery, and that has been immediately on the heels of this spike in short speculative interest. So what do we have to look forward to? I think the rally coming off of the spike in speculative shorts in 2005, that was nothing short of 70% over the next year. In 2008, you had an immediate move higher of 60%. But actually, beyond that sort of first year of 60% growth, it went on, it extended to about 109% gain. So the first part was short covering. The second part was momentum, which carried it from there.
So let me just clarify. You're saying that the guys who are usually wrong, the speculative shorts, right now are in more than they've been in any other time other than these other lows.
Yeah. They're more short the market than they have been in decades. What's important here is that they're more long. Guess when they were more long than they had been in decades?
Probably at 1900.
Oh, fall of 2011. So, I mean, again, we're not talking about a cast of geniuses here. The commercials, frankly, know their business. They know their business. They know when to be long. They know when to be short. They know when to cover, and they know when to protect margins. That's really not what we're seeing in the marketplace today. We have speculative shorts at levels we haven't seen in decades, and we're closer by the day to a short covering squeeze. And what are we witness to? We still have Wall Street badgering the gold owner. We have the Fed confusing all markets as to the fundamental rationale for pricing, and not just in gold, but virtually every asset class, just like the House of Mirrors. All reality is what it is, but it can be grossly distorted to the naked eye. Well, you have to look past that distortion.
Strangely, though, you know, we were talking about the advantage you have if you're not looking into the distorted mirror and you get a clear signal. And, of course, the insiders who can print money and know what's happening ahead of time, that's one of the groups that get that information. But the Chinese, Dave, look at what's happening in Asia, okay? India is having to raise the tax on gold buying and tell their people to stop buying it because they see what's going on.
What is radically happening in India is that there's so much gold being imported in the first part of this year that it is radically distorting their trade balances to the point where everyone's saying, if we don't clamp down on this, if we don't change the rules, if we don't increase taxes, if we don't do something, our trade balance is going to be completely out of whack. So, yeah, the Chinese this week, yeah, surprise, surprise, they approved not one but two gold exchange-traded funds. These are exchange-traded products just like GLD, SGOL, CEF. These are your proxies for the price of gold, metals backing them. But lo and behold, they want to do the same thing in Shanghai.
Well, and where are those metals coming from but the crazy, stupid, distorted West right now?
ETFs in the West send their gold to the East for products for Chinese investors to buy and, again, have the proxy for the metal. You can buy it and sell it with a mouse click if you're in Shanghai, Beijing, or any other city in China. Gold outflows from the U.S. and European ETFs. Okay, the bright side here is that they are stabilizing. So you're not seeing the radical outflows that we saw in the first 90 to 120 days here in the U.S. and Europe. In that circumstance, you had ample supply, in fact, overwhelming supply and inadequate net demand. Central bank demand was strong, but ETF liquidations were overwhelming. So that set of circumstances, obviously, it's leading to lower prices. That's turning over. The next 90 days, you're going to be looking at inadequate supply and ample demand along with higher prices. So watch the path ahead. So keep your eye on the path ahead. If the future price of gold is of interest to you, again, it's also worthy of note that there's been a massive pickup in insider buying at your precious metals miners. Again, these are insiders of folks that are either going out of business or they're looking and saying, the worst is behind us, now it's time to load our personal boats with company shares that no one seems to appreciate. When insiders are selling, take note. We've talked about that over and over and over again. When insiders are buying, take note. They know something about their markets. This is their future. This is their retirement. They're either crazy, off their rocker, and on the way to the poorhouse, or they're right, and we're near a turn in the market.
Well, and you had brought up that George Soros had been loading up on miners. Okay, so he had that going, and he would be considered necessarily an insider.
Well, again, I mean, it's just to the old frustration of Bloomberg reporting and CNBC reporting that Soros sold $2.5 million dollars worth of gold. Meanwhile, he bought, but that did not go announced, $25 million worth of call options on the junior miners. In the same period of time, he decided to take something that was a fairly stable and boring investment in the metals right. and make it a lot racier and a lot primed towards immediate recovery and growth in the miners. And I say immediate because call options have a expire by date. On top of that, you're talking about the part which is most charged in terms of growth.
Well, how about China, though? Again, okay, the Secretary General of China, the China Gold Association, he said, you know, I don't think this dump that you guys did may have had the impact that you wanted. What was the quote?
The dumping recently of holdings in gold exchange-traded products by overseas investors may not prove to be a wise move.
That was an understatement. They just continued to rake it in. And, you know, you were talking about supply being ample out of the ETFs, Dave. We're talking about 400-ounce bars. Okay, Dave, I'm sorry. I don't buy 400-ounce bars. In fact, we sell a lot of gold. I've never sold a 400-ounce bar. The average person's going to go up to maybe a kilo. But these bars, there was a lack of supply of everything smaller than those 400 bars.
So I was on a mountain bike trip over the weekend, and just a quick ride before breakfast, and was observing a few things, and it just had me kind of thinking about lots of things. I've observed over the last decade that investors very often just don't know themselves. Mm. And they're subject to internal pressures and emotional influences, which put them at odds, frankly, with any real long-term investment success. They're greedy when they should be cautious. This goes back to those sort of speculative longs who are buying at the top of the market. And they're cautious when they should be greedy. Again, most investors today would say, well, we're just not interested in gold, or we assume that the price is going even lower when they should be buying. And I think you know what I mean. When we're facing an existential threat, and many investors feel this way, will I outlive my money? Will my portfolio run to zero? When you're in those circumstances and you're experiencing that either frustration or fear, the tendency is to respond on the basis of personal feelings to that visceral threat. Fundamentals in the market, even if they're out there, that gets crowded out by the feelings. Again, objective fundamentals get crowded out by the feelings in the world of subjective threat mm-hmm. and survival.
Yeah, Dave, this decline between 2011 and 2013, it has hurt. But if you look at the chart, it's similar to declines that we've had in the past, right before, as you've pointed out, large moves to the upside.
Yeah, so fixating on numeric loss, not to ignore it, but let's just say that if you fixate on it, you're going to be crowding out other realities. Again, recall that 2005 and 2008 period. Yes, we saw precipitous declines. 25 to 30%
sounds
decline.
The same, yeah.
Before short covering and the natural buying, which came into the market, which took the price to new highs. And again, this is the issue of how quickly we forget past pain, but how easily we are consumed by anything in the present, which is painful.
Well, and David, we live, you know, you were talking about a mountain bike trip.
Right.
Live in a mountain biking community, and Ned Overend is sort of the legend around here, okay? He was the first world champion mountain biker. He wrote a great book, has done a number of videos on how to mountain bike, but one of his key issues is don't look at the front of the bike, look down the trail. Don't look down at the obstacle right in front of you because it's already too late. Go ahead and continue to look at where the goal is. And I'll tell you, Dave, that is an amazing exercise in faith, but it changes your riding.
Well, and you know, I finished the mountain bike ride this weekend. That's what I wanted to mention. So I was explaining to my boys how when you fixate on a root or a rock or a tree, it almost guarantees a direct encounter with that object.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's one particular turn on my favorite trail. It's a very sharp turn. It has a nice sandy patch at the outer edge. And the more you look at the sandy patch, the more there is almost like a magnetic draw to it. It's
Don't
a self-determining, self-defeating outcome. And I've crashed there many times, trying to avoid it. But you know what I was doing? I was giving it my full attention. To avoid the crash, you have to look beyond that point in the trail. Steer your self-control around it. Your eyes go, and your body follows.
That's exactly right.
Which is tough because you're looking at the point of threat, and you actually have to leave it behind. And your natural instinct is to focus on what could damage you, perhaps irreparably, you know, head over heels, so to say. A Superman is what they like to call it in biking parlance. But yeah, so you avoid the crash, you have to look beyond the point, you have to have your eyes directed to that point around the curve, and lo and behold, you get there. It's no different with investing. Fixating on an obstacle versus the road ahead leads to, shall we say, disappointing outcomes. Fixating on a risk variable, frankly, determines the outcome. Fixating on a risk is not what you do to get by a risk.
Well, and it's not just with risks that there's an analogy, Dave. I mean, there's so many analogies, and there are other sports that apply, but let's face it, you've got to keep pedaling. I mean, it can be painful sometimes, but you've got to keep pedaling.
Right. Yeah, the same is true. If you freeze up and don't keep on pedaling, you lose momentum, and any obstacle that is in front of you, you now have an inability, just in terms of the laws of motion, to overcome it. And,
right.
And so there is this sense in which, you know, I came home from the ride and I'm like, boys, listen, this is really important. What is on the horizon is more important than what is 2 inches in front of your tire.
Yeah.
And I've found the fastest way over the handlebars is to fixate on 2 inches immediately in front of me.
Right.
So, you know, where you set your vision determines how much you overcorrect and the likelihood of you not encountering well the obstacles you have to your success. So yes, you have a novice on the trail, which will, if you want to imagine averaging the trail, he's on and off and he's overcorrecting, and this is what you see with a novice. His movements are erratic, he's dodging every obstacle. A more experienced rider on the trail is looking farther ahead. Mm-hmm. The obstacles underneath you actually naturally adapt to and you pass over very quickly as long as your vision rests beyond the point of threat.
So, David, what you're doing, you're equating this horizon with holding on to your gold and accumulating more, because the natural outcome is that we're going to have inflation, we're going to have a devaluation of the dollar, but don't freak out with the price
now. Yeah, sentiment in the gold market reflects a bike wrapped around a tree. It's been a disaster.
Right.
You look at the Holbert Gold Newsletter Sentiment Index. It hit a record low of negative 43 last month. Record low. Negative 43.
That's a prescription for Prozac is what that is.
Well, sentiment is broken. So, I mean, if you're feeling like a battered gold bull, so is every other gold bull.
Yeah.
There's only the difference between those that hold fast and those that throw in the towel. And you know, throwing in the towel, it is most common, guess where? At the lows.
At the bottom.
At the lows. Never at the highs, when it would make more pragmatic sense. But again, you've got the errors of optimism on the upside and the errors of pessimism on the downside. Remember, the market just doesn't care. It doesn't care about your personal circumstances. It doesn't care about your needs. It doesn't care about your wants. It doesn't care about your income expectations. It is a reality unto its own. You need to keep pedaling, and that's going to keep you from falling off the bike altogether. You have to realize that the market is what it is. It will do what it's supposed to do when it wants to do it, not on your own time frame. Whether it is July, August, September, our date with destiny, 3,000 an ounce, 5,000 an ounce, is it this year? No. Is it next year? No. Well, we have to stretch our time horizon to 2016, 17, and 18 to see a $3,000 to $3,500, $5,000 gold price. Sure. Now, so with that in mind, if we keep our eyes on the prize, you're telling me it actually matters to you that there's a $30 dip in the price of gold on a given day. Or let's say there's a $300 dip in the price of gold in a five-day period. On its way to $5,000? You care? You actually care that this is navigating the trail with your eye 2 inches in front of the tire. I can guarantee where you're going, straight over the handlebars. No more, no less. That's where you're going. You have a date with destiny. It's just a very different destiny than the rest of us share.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.